Thanks for tuning in to 96.3 FM Ohm Radio in Charleston. I'm Whitney Powers, and I'm your host today for the series Small Talks, Big Ideas, a weekly 30 plus or minus minute show that is collaborative space shared by four of our community's advocacy organizations, including Lowcountry Local First, the Coastal Conservation League, Charleston Moves, and If You Were Mayor. So while these organizations serve different needs in our community, they are largely aligned in their vision for the future. So Small Talks, Big Ideas is a space for each of these organizations to share their ideas, have tough but necessary conversations, and invite you as listeners into our work. For today's segment, we welcome Steve Warner of the Charleston Regional Development Alliance, whose illustrious title at the organization is Vice President of Global Marketing and Regional Competitiveness. Whew, what a mouthful.
That is a mouthful. And
to discuss some of the elements that the CRDA, and I've like flipped those letters around all through even my notes, so call me on that one. But the CRDA uses that align with livability in the region. So I think there are a lot of people that feel there's a disconnect mm-hmm. between the global and the local. And so we're going to try to find a way for those things to mesh today. The CRDA, in collaboration with the Chamber of Commerce, has just published the first in a three-part process entitled One Region, a Global Competitiveness Strategy. Huh. And we will be talking about some of the findings in this initial document, among other things. And this report is actually pretty chocked with data sets that compare Charleston and the region to cities comparable in size and aspirations, such as Greenville, Nashville, Raleigh, Austin, Jacksonville, even Seattle, mm-hmm. Among others. And so is there anything, Steve, that you would like to add to my brief overview on this One Region report?
Sure, and I'll try to do that concisely. I mean, it's essentially meant to be a blueprint for long-term regional prosperity. It is a partnership between the CRDA and the Charleston Metro Chamber of Commerce, but it is led by a 70-member stakeholder group that has representatives from public sector, private sector, academia, and nonprofit throughout the three-county region. So you're right, this is the first phase of three phases. The second report's being completed as we speak, which will look at those economic clusters and industry sectors that we should focus on for quality job growth. And then the final report will essentially be an action plan for many, many stakeholders throughout the three-county region. Our consultants are describing it as a coordinating document. So it's much more holistic than a traditional economic development strategy. There's a lot going on in there. And your competitive assessment report is, in fact, chock full of wonky data, which we love.
Well, I kind of found it interesting anyway. Let's just segue initially into this concept of wonkiness, and I just want to jump right into your thoughts on how global thinking might actually enhance a local atmosphere. The report discusses global fluency, which I thought was a great phrase, mm-hmm. and it's both provocative and intriguing, I think, for Charlestonians to grasp as important. We tend to think of ourselves kind of navel-gazing, pretty much, first out on all kinds of weirdness, historically speaking, something maybe we've lost a little bit, but rather than speak to this concept of in terms of trade, which is a lot of the data I noticed, perhaps we can take it down a notch and consider how this can play out maybe in some of our leadership and development choices mm-hmm. sort of going forward.
Well, it is a very interesting concept and one that we've been wrestling with a lot. It is fundamentally about trade, and we've had tremendous success as a community from our connections to global communities from a trade standpoint, and maybe less so from a connectivity from a cultural standpoint with other communities. But yes, I think back to your idea of global versus local, the quality of place here is phenomenal, and that's contributed a tremendous amount to our economic success, both in terms of being able to attract companies and entrepreneurs and people that want to start their businesses here or grow their businesses here, but also talent. And so we definitely need to work to preserve all those quality of place issues that we love, and at the same time work to understand what it takes to compete globally, which again is what this One Region strategy is about.
Well, I know when my family's always traveled, we find ourselves looking and being really interested in finding things that are uniquely local, and that are places to eat or shop or visit. And I know that we have we attract a lot of people who come here to see those well-known brand stores. Growing up, and I don't even want to tell you what decade I'm talking about, but it was one of those things that you found, that you felt in a small town that you had made it when you had a McDonald's, which is kind of unfortunate that our mindset sort of drifted in that direction. And it does seem that we could theoretically be heading to a time when those kinds of everywhere, nowhere spots seem to throw things completely out of kilter. And we've got commercial rents that are pretty frightening for small business mm-hmm. owners, and nonprofits are sort of finding that they can't be sort of close to their service area. We recently had a visitor to our website who posted an idea about how unique Charleston is, which you've spoken to, but how fragile and endangered that seems when chain and franchises proliferate. So I guess one of the bigger kind of issues are, how does the local economy, how do we grow a kind of, maintain a kind of growth in our kind of local idiosyncratic claims, and also recognize that that's actually one of the qualities that bring people here. Right. Either it's here to, as you say, to the talent issue and the attracting outside businesses. And when you say businesses, I'm sure you're talking more, part of your effort really has as much to do with kind of the Boeings and the big employers as anything else. Sort of quality jobs and things, more so those H&Ms and those kind of stores. I don't necessarily see that as a regional kind of thing in terms of the way that y'all operate.
No, we don't recruit retail. We don't work to attract retail. I think our economy has transitioned from more of a service-based economy to more of a knowledge economy, and I think that's something that's hard for people to grapple with. And yes, a lot of that is the Boeings of the world, but it's also smaller companies too, smaller, more entrepreneurial companies. And so the same issues that you talked about, affordability, which I know we're going to talk about in terms of affordability for individuals, it's an issue for companies, especially entrepreneurial companies. We've got that fast-growing tech sector, information technology and software. A lot of those companies are small companies that are growing quickly, and affordability for commercial space is an issue for them just as much as it's an issue for a nonprofit or, a local culinary entrepreneur like Michael Shimtoff at Butcher & Bee, who's, basically moving Butcher & Bee because he's getting pushed further up the peninsula. So that's an issue across the board in terms of how do we balance recruiting large companies, fostering innovation and entrepreneurship among our existing community, as well as retaining and helping to grow the people that are already here. So those are, those are the three legs of economic development. People in our community tend to think of it more as just the attraction piece, but we firmly believe that best practice is to do all three of those things and do them well.
Yeah, because you don't want the stool to fall over.
Right. You don't want it to be overbalanced one way or the other.
Right. Not a comfortable situation. So, can this concept of global fluency underscore how we can, in fact, place a greater value on what is local? How can we as a community, there are people certainly that advocate for local, the local grown thing. But sometimes you don't find that's widespread, even in the community, to sort of say, let's go look what we've got. Although I think that there's an awful lot of that. The restaurant scene in Charleston certainly benefits from capitalizing on local fare. We're looking at
right.
that chefs coming from other places are sort of finding their way here. So all of a sudden, those kind of local, the Martha Lou's Kitchen and the Dave's Carryout are certainly seen alongside some of these people who have you know, who are coming from, you know, who are importing
right.
Things. I mean, fig has been a stalwart in the local scene, Mike Latta, and that whole kind of, you know, cooking what is local, what comes in that day. So maybe there's some examples that we can sort of bounce around a little bit on, you know, kind of making sure that we're holding up and not just moving on to the next best, the next greatest, hippest, hot
sure.
thing, but really holding on to some of those things that really are the signatures of what got us here.
Right. Well, I think the idea is ultimately for us to be a world-class place to live, work, and play. And there's a lot that goes into that. You mentioned Mike Latta versus some of the newer chefs that are moving here from Manhattan. There's been a lot of press about that. You know, Mike ultimately came from somewhere else, too,
true.
10 or 15 years ago. So I think there's something special and unique and really magical about Charleston. And when I say Charleston, I mean the greater metro area. And there's lots of different opportunities for local versus non-local to come into that. I mean, our focus is really about growing the economy and having that economic growth transition all the way through the economy so that there's opportunities for prosperity for everyone.
Right.
And so I think there's room in that, but I think there's also, to your point, yes, how do we find that balance? And I think finding that balance is a combination of a lot of different players and a lot of different actors. I know, for example, Low Country Local First has looked at a lot of best practices in other communities that are policies about how do you maintain that balance. I know that South Carolina Community Loan Fund, that is focused on housing affordability, has also looked, and I guess Bill Stanfield at Metanoia have talked about some things they've seen in other communities that help to keep people from being forced out of their neighborhoods, keep businesses from being forced out. But then you have to balance that with, we are a capitalist society, and how do you do that, and how do you navigate that? So we're not an advocacy or policy group,
right.
but I certainly understand that tension and that balance, and I personally believe that there's room for all of that.
Well, I mean, Charleston is a port city, and it's
right.
it's been influenced by many, many things that have come from other places, and in some way, shape, or form, those things have generally gotten mutated when they've gotten here
right.
to tweaked in order to actually become somewhat local and to be adopted, you know, in some ways. I mean, I think we kind of adopted Mike Latta and the fig
as
our own. and so but Martha Lou's Kitchen as well, and Dave's Carryout. I mean, those are pretty important features in the landscape, mm-hmm. the food landscape. So getting back to this report, Steve, it is quite a lot to digest. It's 140 pages. Lots of nice graphs, though, I have to say. Those 140 pages, it's not like fine print. You know, I don't feel like I'm reading Dickens or anything. And I've only spent a bit of time with it myself and really can hardly grasp so far its reach, its potential reach or impact. But it does highlight some interesting issues that were central to the recent mayoral campaign, for instance. And, mm-hmm. and we knew that on the ground because of the way we operated during, if you were mayor, was
right.
really sort of initiated during that season. And there's no way in our brief conversation that we're going to be able to do justice to everything in the report.
Right.
There are a few parts of it that I probably don't really want to talk about today. So, but let's do talk a little bit about transportation.
Okay.
Since we hear lots of concerns of, and I say traffic in quotes, congestion, public transportation, alternative transportation, and those have all been front and center during the recent campaigns, and it does keep coming up. I mean, every time I have a conversation, it's like, well, what's the number one thing? And, you know, those things figure very highly in every conversation. The report ventures into this arena in a couple of places. One is in the discussion of infrastructure, specifically, and then there's the overview of the area's quality of life. And I will say it's very nice the way this sort of compartmentalizes mm-hmm. things and allows you to kind of reference and cross-reference. And I did think that the most interesting part was really when it just compared us to other places. I mean, that's always the number of road miles, the congestion, revenues, commuting costs. And one of the things that kind of unnerved me was, you know, saying, oh, we don't have nearly as many road miles as other cities. And it made me sort of fear, you know, does that mean that this report is going to say, oh, we need to build more roads? I'm not sure our geography can stand it. But are we going to make bad choices, which is, you know, pretty endemic. So what do you think may be the options that maybe came up in some of the stakeholder meetings and about how we can efficiently use, I mean, that's really where we are now, is efficiently using resources, and I'm sure that comes to bear on everything you do. And really, how creative do you think we're going to have to get in order to really kind of bring to bear some of these, some of the issues that are related to transportation?
So that was about 13 questions, Whitney, so I'm going to take them one at a time.
It was meant to be.
Well, I think if you'll bear with me for a sec, first of all, that report is really trying to look at the connectivity between a lot of the different issues that we're talking about, the interconnectivity between economic growth, transportation, infrastructure, housing affordability, talent development, innovation and entrepreneurship. So it does really work hard to showcase that those things are all interrelated.
And you can't de-link any of them, really.
I don't think you can, and I think that's part of the intent of the report, is to make people understand that these are interconnected, multi-layered, complex issues that we're wrestling with. I guess stepping back a sec, I think it's important to talk about the context. And so if you look at 5 to 7 years ago, we were coming out of a recession. We had, 20 to 30,000 people still out of work. We had almost 10% unemployment. So these challenges that we're wrestling with now are essentially a result of our economic success over the last 5 to 7 years. So if you'll bear with me for being wonky for a minute, we've had 300% increase in exports. And so that's not port volume, that's goods and services built here that are being sold outside the region. So that's, a lot of that's Boeing and transportation equipment, also automotive, but it's also software and technology. We've had 10% increase in household incomes. We've had about a 25% increase in the GRP for the region, the gross regional product for the region. So we've had some really unprecedented success. You don't see a lot of communities across the country dealing with this kind of success. And that success has also contributed us having really double the population growth of the U.S. average. So, a lot of the investments that have been made in growing the economy, we as a community haven't tracked along with that in terms of making investments in infrastructure and education and looking at things that can affect housing affordability. So that's a long contextual answer to your several questions.
Yeah, that raises a pretty interesting point. I mean, essentially, at the same time that we invest in attracting businesses and growth industries and all those other things, that we also need to sort of understand that we need to invest in all the things that are going to go along with that. And that the payoff, the payoff is jobs and tax base and all the, all the sort of extenuating kinds of items. I mean, an example being, I grew up in a small town, a tiny town. Then it had an ITT engineering office that employed, 50 engineers. And in this small town, those 50 engineers, their spouses taught in the schools. We had amazing kind of education system that was really a spinoff of these high-tech, thoughtful people being in the area. And that is sort of a long-term thinking about this, that's an advantage that we were probably not measuring against attracting these businesses, is seeing how that actually infiltrates, not just because Boeing is making contributions, financial contributions to this, that, or the other nonprofit, but that really the people themselves infiltrate into the system, the economic system, and the social system that's here. So there's a payback, but it requires, you know, continued investment,
right,
or it'll leave.
Right. I mean, we talk about traffic congestion as a threat to our quality of place and our livability, but it's a threat to those businesses as well. I mean, Bosch, automotive manufacturer that's been here 30 years, built in fairly low-density area in Dorchester County 30 years ago that's no longer a low-density area. And they have more than 80 trucks a day coming in and out doing just-in-time, just-in-sequence component delivery for what they're making. They can't get those trucks in and out of there. You know, they can't grow their business. And to your point, we ultimately, they stop growing, we start losing not only the tax base that's with that, but also the intellectual capital that comes with that, the influence on the school system, the influence on the rest of the community. All good things, again, in balance with a lot of the things we were talking about. You know, back to the traffic congestion and your point about concerns about showing that we have fewer road miles per capita than other communities. You know, one way to look at that is a fear of the recommendation is going to be just build more roads. The other way to look at it is we probably didn't have enough road capacity for the population we had 10 years ago compared to other communities. We do have some challenges of geography, but I think the quick answer is it's not just about building roads. We need to do it all.
Another tidbit in there was in fact that one of the issues was that we had more cars with only one driver, mm-hmm, than all the other sort of suspects in this data set. And I did find that pretty interesting and probably a pretty good target, a pretty good item to sort of put in our crosshairs, as it were.
Not only do 80% of the people here commute by themselves in a car, but less than 5% of people here telecommute. And we really don't have a culture of flex time in our community. Like when I moved to Atlanta in the late 90s, they had just come from having the Olympics, you know, a few years before, and that's when they really instituted the concept of flex time and telecommuting in that community, because they have much bigger traffic congestion challenges,
right,
than we do. And so we really haven't gotten there yet with some of that. But again, back to your single commuters in cars, that's interrelated to lack of density. And the other thing that really jumped out at me in the report was the growth in jobs versus the growth in housing, and they're geographically disconnected.
Right.
So
right.
Low density and you know, shortage of road miles means more congestion.
Well, I did want to note that that the Texas Transportation Institute at Texas A&M was a source of a lot of this transportation data, and they're the, from what I understand, the nation's premier transportation, mm-hmm, research program. They actually publish a semi-regular report.
It's gotten more semi lately
on urban traffic congestion. But in August, there was an article that the Brookings Institute, mm-hmm, published that noted how the tone of the report has actually changed, because it's sort of moving away from movement and mobility of vehicles, and becoming more about how local transportation systems can get people to jobs, people to education, people, you know, how do the transportation as a system actually connect people to the places where they need to be and want to be. And that's a signal to big thinkers on transportation, I think. And in fact, that was sort of the note, that was really what made it newsworthy, I guess. Of course, if you looked at the Texas Transportation, it was even more data, a little even more intense than what I've looked at from your organization. but that they're beginning, these big thinkers on transportation, which obviously includes the federal government, who finance an awful lot of the transportation construction that we're talking about, they're beginning to they're beginning to introduce evaluations, research, and grant making that relates to increasing efficient use of scarce roadway space. I mean, the space for roadways is not necessarily going to be there for us, and total transportation options need to be considered. Shared cars, buses, bikes, and walking. I mean, all of those things kind of working together. So I just wanted to point that out because I did, you know, I felt pretty smarty smart about knowing where some of that data came from. So it does suggest that quality of life means expanding transportation options. Public transportation, bicycling and walking could really make for workforce development opportunities. I mean, that's kind of a buzz phrase, but coupled with that, which I think is something that people don't necessarily kind of think about, is that's lower individual transportation costs. That if you have ways to connect people to where they work and play and want to be, mm-hmm. then their cost to get there can go down.
Absolutely.
Because one person in a car is the most expensive way of moving people around. So, and maybe if you could just touch on some other advantages maybe to an expansion of the region's transportation system that you see kind of borne out in this report, or really how that relates to the sort of economic development. Really, how does transportation, maybe some examples of how you see transportation sort of translating into sustainable economic
sure.
opportunities and development?
Well, again, just to emphasize the first point, which is it's a huge threat to our quality of place. So if we can't both grow, attract, and retain the talent we need to feed these knowledge economy companies, because nobody wants to sit in a car for an hour and a half by themselves, or they can't live near where they work, maybe better said, or have an alternative way to get there, then that's going to hinder our ability to continue to grow the economy in a sustainable way. I think you do have to have better roadway infrastructure, first and foremost, but I think you have to have more alternative forms of transportation, public transportation. That was one of the other notes in the study. More than 80% of the people are commuting by themselves. Transit ridership is extremely low. The people that are able to bike and walk to work is extremely low. So we've got to figure out ways to get all of those things.
Right.
Infrastructure and resources, all those things. I think the other opportunities within that is, as we've become, again, more of a knowledge economy, we're getting looks from the types of companies that we never really have gotten looks from before. One quick example is, and this is probably 4 or 5 years ago, we received a request for proposal or a request for information from an anonymous company that had a tremendous amount of questions in their RFI about bicycle infrastructure. And we didn't make the short list on that. And a couple of years later, New Belgium announced in Asheville. And I don't know for a fact that that's who the RFI was from, but if I were a betting man, I would bet that's who it was from. So that's another example of how, and that's in a recruiting example, of how our lack of alternative forms of transportation may hinder our ability to grow with also some other kind of cool non-traditional companies. I think the other ways is you have, again, that software and information technology sector that primarily wants to locate in an urban core because that's where their employees want to be. But, finding affordable places to put their companies, having other ways for people to get to their company other than car, having parking, having, food and entertainment options around that is getting to be a harder and harder mix. And I think if we had maybe better public transit, better bicycle infrastructure, other things that would incentivize people to, whether it's carpool, ride public transportation, ride their bike, then that's going to both alleviate some of our congestion problems, but it's also going to provide opportunities for new business growth that maybe we didn't have before.
Well, do you feel that the governmental leaders at the county level and basically the regional level here, they're really open to kind of what this report actually spells out? or may spell out?
I think they're open to it. And again, I think it goes back to that context we were talking about. This growth has been both extreme and rapid. And so I think there is a realization that we can't do things the same way we've been doing them before. The question is how.
Right.
And what is that balance? And how do we work together to do that? And so that's essentially what this one region strategy is ultimately about. The final report that'll come out in early May, the consultants are referring to it as a coordinating document. So
right.
It'll have recommendations for lots and lots of stakeholders beyond, you know, the sponsoring organizations of CRDA and Charleston Metro Chamber of Commerce.
So how long has this been going on?
We started in September. One quick note is that we've done this every 5 years in the 20 years we've been an organization. So this builds on previous work. The last strategy was called Opportunity Next. This is the first time we've partnered with the Metro Chamber. And again, it's in that context of we have had a lot of economic success. Therefore, we have a lot of different challenges we have to wrestle with. And that is more of a holistic look at how we do this versus simply an economic development, maybe job creation strategy.
Yeah, I think it's really cool. And I think that's, you know, it's very important for us to realize that, and I think you'll find that there are lots of entities that are interested in sort of seeing all these things kind of work together as opposed to any single, you know, well, they want one thing, we want another. I think
right.
this is sort of has the potential to being more to bringing more people along, I suppose.
Absolutely.
So now that kind of it brings up and brings us to mind that sort of we've touched briefly on a concept that's really a big deal for our region, and it complicates the political dynamic and requires a significant buy-in from people throughout the region. Not to say transportation doesn't, but to date, many people have been resistant to the idea of affordability with a capital A.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a new issue. I remember moving here as a graduate after finishing graduate school in New York. And I found that while some things were less expensive, housing wasn't necessarily that much less expensive by comparison on a scale. It didn't sort of more than make up for being in one place rather than the other. Even for a recent college graduate, it was still a budgeting challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And not to speak of suddenly the cost of having and owning and using a car, which had not been an issue. So it would seem this phenomena has really grown increasingly worse, and affordable housing is really an issue. The options have shifted further and further away from places where the jobs are, and I think you mentioned that
mm-hmm.
earlier. I know the chamber has been struggling or tangling with this issue. The South Carolina Community Loan Fund, which you mentioned, is also very enlightened in that area. So the study does point out that we're not just talking about poor and disadvantaged. I mean, you know, that's one thing, and that is certainly needs to be addressed. But it's the ways to tie workforce and the development of talent to local and these larger businesses. So let's just talk about this elephant in the room, as I would call it.
It's a big elephant. Housing affordability, just like traffic congestion, are two of the biggest threats to our quality of life. And you're absolutely right. It is not a new issue, but with this economic growth and population growth we've experienced, it's more exacerbated. And again, it's interrelated to many of the other issues we talked about. Lack of roadway infrastructure, where the jobs are versus where the housing opportunities are being different. I lived in Atlanta for many years, and that's the first place I heard the phrase drive till you qualify. and so that's a lot of what's happening here. Whenever we present this data, and we've looked at this with the Metro Chamber as part of our regional economic scorecard project that we do every 5 years, which is a benchmark study. And invariably, when we present this information, somebody raises their hand and said, you know, that's, you know, you're looking at regional data and it's skewed because of Kiowa and South Abroad. And that's not true. The the Charleston Metro Chamber and Community Loan Fund and others have looked at the fact that it is housing affordability is an issue in every single zip code in our three-county metro.
Right.
So that's kind of a false argument that it's skewed because of those. And the data, you know,
it doesn't just go in a big dump and sort itself out and say, here's the low and here's the high.
Yeah, and I think you have to acknowledge that part of that is because, on average, our wage levels here are about 10 to 15% lower than the national average. So you've got, you know, again, not just housing affordability, but cost of living index to the national average about a half point above.
Mm-hmm.
And average wages at about 85%. So you have a little bit lower wages. You have an interesting geography that includes lots of water.
Right.
You have lack of roadway miles. You have lack of public transportation and alternative modes of transportation, which, and as we said, the job creation has primarily been in the urban core, and the housing, the extreme growth in housing that has been built that is more affordable is primarily in the maybe beyond the 526 area. So again, that's the affordability issue is a combination of factors which is directly related to the traffic congestion. So it's a big thorny elephant too.
Well, I mean, I got an email from my neighborhood association, which is downtown. Mm-hmm. And the president of my neighborhood association makes this comment, says that we don't have an urban core in the Charleston region. And and I thought, oh, this is really a good strategy. So maybe you should speak to that, because there are obviously people that would rather there not be perceived urban core because they feel, you know, maybe it's, you know, they're being protective, or I don't know. It struck me as a very odd remark, because I think, you know, the core of activity in the region, certainly there are lots of places where that happens, but identity-wise,
right,
it's downtown Charleston.
Well, I would expand that, I mean, to downtown, North Charleston, West Ashley, Mount Pleasant. I mean, we do have an interesting geography that's kind of chopped up, but it is a metro. It's a fast-growing metro. We're ranked as 76th largest metro overall in the U.S. We've got over 720,000 people in that three-county region. But, yeah, if you look at the population density and you look at the where the jobs are, it is in that Charleston, North Charleston, West Ashley, Mount Pleasant kind of core. So you can argue semantically that it's not a core if there's rivers running through it. But
okay,
I would choose to differ. But I think it's still it's kind of a false argument. I don't understand what the point
is
there.
Yeah, it struck me as kind of quirky as well, and not and sort of self-denial, I suppose.
But back to your original point, it is not an issue for, you know, it is not just people that have maybe lower education levels or lower income levels that can't afford to live here. It is, you know, a 26-year-old person making decent money starting their career,
right,
and working in one of these faster-growing industries. And, you know, that's a challenge for us from an, you know, sustainability standpoint.
Oh.
Us meaning the region, not us meaning CRDA.
Oh, yes, there is that we versus we.
Right.
Well, it's a conundrum, and obviously the waterways and the creeks and things make road building, for instance, very complicated, and connectivity is really a phrase that sort of is coupled with transportation, that you basically... Mm-hmm. can have multiple routes to get to different places. And here we suffer from the lack of multiple routes to actually get from point A to point B very
right.
often. And so that really complicates
absolutely
things a lot. So I think it's important to mention there are some definite links between the issues. And I think that's interesting in this report. And I hope that people will sort of seek out this as it sort of comes together. I hope you'll make it available widely once mm-hmm. once it's been published in its whole. And there's some definite links. It was nice to see that this is making those links and really kind of expanding on the way some of these things are connected, inextricably connected, one to the next. And the Chamber of Commerce, frankly, has really struggled with getting their message out in a sort of, I hate to say it, an untainted way. It would seem to be that your organization, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about how you're different from some of these other entities and how your vision is maybe a little different than, say, that of the chamber or that of the local government or that might come from a nonprofit sector.
Okay.
That would be very helpful because I think it's a little complicated to sort of think about what your organization is versus... is it quasi, just kind of tell us a little bit about where y'all come from and what your objectives are in a bigger, in the big picture.
Well, we articulate our mission as serving as a catalyst for long-term regional prosperity by attracting the world's best companies, talent, and entrepreneurs. So that's how we articulate our mission. What's maybe different about us is that we are truly a public-private partnership. So our investors and our leadership are public sector. So our leadership and our investors include the three counties and the five largest municipalities, over 60 private sector companies, as well as academic organizations or institutions. So the local colleges and universities, all of those people at a senior level sit on our board and are our governing body. So that is unique. I mean, being a true public-private partnership and is different from some of the other organizations you've talked about. I think our DNA goes back to the Navy base closure in the early 90s, and that was the catalyst for the formation of our group to have a really intentional effort to focus on economic sustainability. In the early days, it was all about job creation. That was it. It was just trying to replace the 20 to 30,000 jobs that were going to be going away with the base closure. And it has evolved over the years. And I think you're seeing the results of that in this report, in this study, that we're in a very different place economically. We have different challenges. We have different opportunities. And how do we really take a holistic look at that? The Charleston Metro Chamber is a strong partner for us. They're a strong ally for us, but they have a very different role. The oversimplified way to say that is that we market the region and they focus on product development. But they're also an advocacy and a policy organization, and we're not. So, and the issues that that we've been talking about this entire time are complicated and increasingly emotional issues.
Right.
And so they've got a tough job.
Right. Well, it's going to require a certain finesse in order to turn some of the appeal to the hearts and minds on some of these issues. And I know the chamber has run up against it a lot. I mean, the trying to sell, and we have those catchphrases that people are really kicked back against now, the gathering place and density and all these become the hot button. We don't want to hear those kinds of things in the general populace, and I think the interesting thing about the way this information has been presented that I found appealing was that it was presented in such a way that it's like, that you really have a choice. You have a choice to sort of create, this kind of place, because the trade-off is this. That it linked into this is something else that you really want.
Right.
And so I think there's a way that this is presented and so far, that I hope sort of stands up through the whole course of things, that in fact, this document presents a choice. And the choice is not just well, you either buy into this or we have nuclear devastation. But it's really as in a, you know, that this can actually enhance the local quality of life. And I think that, you know, that particular presentation hasn't found its way into the these kinds of reports and things that have often been, you know, shuffled around. You know, most of what we get is you have to do this, you have to do this, you have to do this, and people don't really like to be told that they have to do anything. that to say, if you do this, you will get, you know, the if mm-hmm. then is an attractive kind of presentation.
Right.
And so I hope that that holds up in the coming couple of months or so, that before we actually see the action plan.
Well, and you know, Whitney, I think that's well said. I think again, that's why we start with data. It is a complicated issue. Or all of these interrelated issues are complicated. It is emotional for many, many people. And I get it too. I've moved away, I moved back because of how much I love this place and how much I want to be a part of it. But people have different viewpoints. One of the things that the attitude that we take in facilitating this type of planning process is the how, or, you know, the process is just as important as the outcome. We could sit down and write a strategy with 10 smart people in a room, and it would be a pretty good strategy. But if we didn't have the buy-in from as broad a cross-section of people as possible within the community, whether they're elected officials or nonprofit leaders or private sector leaders, or, you know, to your point, the general public winning hearts and minds, we're not going to be able to effectively make those decisions. And I think your premise is absolutely right. We do have a choice, and so it's about how can we be intentional about what we want this place to be. Real quick comment, our current board chair is Anita Zucker, who many, many people know. She's a fantastic human being that has done so much for not only our community, but for the entire state and beyond. But she will really quickly tell you that the reason she does so much is that she wants to leave a better world for her children and grandchildren. And I think that gets lost in these conversations a lot, is the decisions we're making now have an effect 20 and 30 years in the future.
Well, when I moved here, there were a lot of people who had grown up here who had to leave because there weren't the jobs for them. And you see some of them coming back,
mm-hmm.
and because they find that there are more opportunities, they're coming back for the same, some of the same reasons, that the quality of life here is better than what they've found in other places. So that's, you know, it bodes well, I guess. And we've still got a lot of work to do.
Absolutely.
So of course I'd be remiss if I didn't get to ask my ever-present question. What would you do, Steve, if you were mayor?
I'm going to give you a couple answers.
And this is on the record, but not in your role of dukedom.
I don't know where the duke thing came from, but I think that's interesting. We could explore that in another conversation. If I were mayor, I mean, again, I've got to take a regional perspective on this. Again, back to the complexity of these issues like transportation and traffic congestion and housing affordability. No single entity is going to be able to affect that. And we've got 27 municipalities. So asking me if I were mayor, I have to first think, which mayor am I?
So, okay, King. Duke is probably better, you know?
Okay. But I think, you know, and these municipalities do a good job already of working together. But I think these are new challenges that we haven't had to face before. So I think back to your question about how creative can we be, I think if I were mayor, I would somehow want these 27 different municipalities to be working in newer and more creative ways together. So that's one thought. The other, and is something that you and I have talked about before, is there are many communities across the country that are looking at how do they use technology to foster more and more varied public input on these really complicated and serious issues.
Right.
The traditional methodology is you have a city or county council meeting and you have public input and you have the 300 or 400 very, very emotional people on the extreme side, either side,
right,
as opposed to using whether it's crowdsourcing or surveys or social media or whatever to get more thoughtful input on, you know, how should we answer this question, again, for the implications that it'll have in 20 or 30 years. And, you know, being the data guy that I am, and using information and data to actually support those decisions. So those are my two answers.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Steve. And this has been a lot of fun. I appreciate you joining me this week and with If You Were Mayor. And it's always nice to see you. You're such a positive guy, and I'm glad you're working that space the way you are. And thank you so much. We do need to kind of know that what we've got local is pretty special, but what that pretty special is actually the kind of thing that kind of is sustainable only if we can encourage people that want to move here or who want to grow businesses here from all different walks of life.
Absolutely.
To feel that they actually are in the right place.
Right.
And it's a place.
Yeah. So. Well, I really appreciate the opportunity. It's always great to have these conversations with you. I know that you think about a lot of the same things that we're working on, and I really appreciate what you're doing with If You Were Mayor, and appreciate OM Radio as well. This is fun.
Oh, great. Well, I look forward to seeing the report in its fully formed and vetted manner, and hopefully it won't just sit on a shelf. So, I think it offers some real opportunities for our local leaders of all stripes. And
well, one quick note, if people would like to see information about the strategic planning process or an executive summary of that report, there is a website called OneRegionStrategy.com. So we'd be remiss if we didn't say that. So go check that out. We will be posting the executive summary of the second phase within the next couple of weeks, and the public rollout will be the first week of May.
Cool. Very cool. Well, that wraps up this segment of Small Talks, Big Ideas with If You Were Mayor. And thank you again for tuning in to OM Radio 96.3, your nonprofit radio station in Charleston, South Carolina. And we'll be back in about a month, for another deep dive. Catherine Zomer will be joining us from Enough Pie to really sort of talk about maybe some on-the-ground community sorts of enterprises. And so look us up online. We're at ifyouweremayor.com. And please be happy to hear any questions or feedback and ideas for the future. Thanks a lot. Talk to you next time. Bye.